Hello from Holden Village. Today is June 15th, 1998, and in the Creekside room this afternoon, we have Jeannie Olson, and she is going to be talking about people of the faith, gifts and blessings for and from the dying. And this is tape number 98-2, OLJ. So let's go listen to Jeannie and the discussion.
Why I kind of put this class together, and I teach it to student chaplains at our hospital, and I've taught it to our befrienders that are our lay ministers at Calm Hospital. I've taught it to ministers in churches and so on, any place that wants me to do it, because I really think it's an important thing for all of us to know how to do. So today, kind of what I'm going to do is, I'm already going to tell you right up front, I'm probably going to break the rules, and the rule is you're supposed to have a third of the time for discussion. Well, this is kind of an hour and 15 minutes, and I'm trying to get it down to 50 minutes so that there can be time to talk, because I know that's important. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to try and get through all of this. I'm going to stop a couple places and ask questions. But what I'm going to ask is, if you want to tell a story or share an experience, I'd ask you to hold that till the end, and I will stay as long as there's people here to do that so that we can get in this material, simply because I think it's important stuff. But I also want to be able to hear the stories that you have to share about this. But we may have to go over the hour, and after the hour is up, anyone who wants to leave can. What we're going to do today is I'm going to talk about how to alleviate the fears of someone who is dying, how to talk them through their transition from this world to the next if you're literally sitting there as they're dying, how to listen to their symbolic language, because many times people who are dying don't speak to us in terms that we understand. They use metaphors. So we're going to talk about how to interpret those metaphors. We're going to talk about when people are dying and they see someone who has previously died and how to handle situations like that. It's really practical stuff. It is sometimes difficult, and I have some Kleenex in my backpack if anybody needs it. Because at times it brings up stories in your own life, experiences that you've had, and you're thinking, and I also want to tell you, don't beat yourself up if after you, or while you're hearing this, you think, oh, I wish I would have, or if only I had known. Well, you didn't. Now you will, and so now it's a different situation. So please, again, don't beat yourself up. The dying I'm going to talk about today is from a progressive illness to terminal. It's not those people that die instantly of a heart attack or a car accident. It's the people with AIDS, it's the people with cancer, it's the people with long-term lung diseases and so on. The other book I'm going to refer to is Into the Light, A Simple Way to Pray with the Sick and Dying. And Ron DelVinay in his book says, I no longer see death as an event, but as a process. And that's the kind of dying I'm going to talk about today. In their book, Maggie Callahan and Patricia Kelly coined a word called nearing death awareness. And those are things that we're going to talk about today. As their reality expands, things happen in that special time, and that's what we'll be talking about. And they discovered in their hundreds of patients that several reoccurring themes occurred and events, and those are the things that, as I said, we're going to talk about. I'm going to use some of their experiences, and I'm going to relate some of my own experiences as a hospital chaplain. Many times what we say is these people are confused, they're on morphine, you know, they're in a semi-comatose state, so we're not going to count what they're saying. And I'm going to show today how we do need to count that. The founder of hospice, Dr. Sanders, said, you matter until the last moment of your life. We will do all we can not only to help you die peacefully, but also to live until you die. And that means really taking into account those things that people say as they are dying. Now, when someone's dying, you want to bring them comfort in four areas. Physical, of course, and thank God hospitals now will give you enough morphine to control the pain and do the best they can to do that. Nurses and doctors take care of that aspect, but we, the family and friends, are going to help take care of the emotional, social, and spiritual aspects of comfort that the medical people can handle. And those are much more subtle, much more difficult to define, and that's why we have to listen so carefully. The important thing is we can't ever force our opinion of how somebody should die on that person. That person, when they're dying, gets to call the shots of what their death is going to be about. The saddest bedside scene I've ever seen happened to a friend of mine, not a close friend, many years before I was a chaplain. She found out that she had breast cancer, and she took it to her prayer group. I believe in prayer when it comes to illness, but that's all she did. The cancer metastasized, so she went to a clinic in Chicago where they use nutrition. I highly believe in nutrition and vitamins, but it metastasized further. They brought her home, they performed surgery, it was too late, the cancer was spreading. I went to visit her. I was told before I went in the room, Jeannie, she believes that she is going to be healed miraculously by God so that he can use her as a vehicle that shows that miracles still happen. So she is not talking about her own dying, and she doesn't believe she's dying, so don't mention it. I walked into the hospice room, and they're saying, you know, about hospice, when you're in hospice, you already know that people have 6 months to live, or less. And she was wrestling and struggling in her bed, and the only image that I can use is it reminded me of the biblical story of Jacob wrestling all night long, and that she was wrestling with death itself. And as I looked at her family standing around the bedside, they were saying, Mom, it's going to be okay. This is just a bump in the road. Hold on, take Jesus' hand. He's going to show you, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. She died never going past the stage of denial that she was dying and that she was going to get a miracle. And that family went through grief in the most unhealthy grief I've ever seen, because they were never able to talk about the death, come to grips with it, talk to each other about it. The most unhealthy situation I have ever seen. But the bottom line is, the person who's dying calls the shots. So what if you, as a friend or family member, walk into a situation and the patient is in denial, and the spouse is angry, and the daughter is depressed, and the son is in bargaining, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All of which are very natural places to be when we're facing death. But they're not good if you get stuck in them. And so you walk into a situation, whether it's family or friends, and see this. What do you do? What do you do? Well, the first thing to do is nothing except listen. You don't come in there to fix it, and you don't come in there to give them the solutions. You come in there and say, you know, how's it going for you? You know, I see your mom is, or I see Aunt Tilly is, or I see what's happening for you. And allow them to talk about where they are, about the bargaining, about the anger at the hospitals, and about et cetera, et cetera. Get them to talk, because they really don't want you to fix anything, but they want to be heard, and they want their pain heard. So a person is going to choose, the person who's dying is going to choose a few special people to talk to honestly. They're not going to talk to the person who walks in and prattles on about nothing, because they're too afraid themselves. And you know people like this. I had a friend of mine died 2 months ago. Her sister, whenever she went to visit her, talked about all the things she was doing in the choir and the trip she was taking to Europe. Well, she's not going to choose that person to talk to. They're not going to choose a person who's afraid to talk about death. If you're afraid to talk about death, this person isn't going to talk with you, because they know that this isn't a subject you're comfortable with. So this person is going to choose someone who will listen, who will understand, who will not try and judge where they are, but allows them the freedom to just talk. So what do? To help that person, you ask them a few very wide open-ended questions. Are you going to be all right? You say to this loved one. Now maybe the person's going to say, oh sure, I'm just going to be fine. I just had surgery, I'm taking chemotherapy, they got it all, it's done. Or maybe they're going to say to you, you know, nobody else will talk about it, but I'm not going to be fine. I know that I could die of this cancer. I know I could die of this AIDS, but nobody in my family wants to talk about it. Or maybe you say, can you talk about what's happening to you? And maybe they'll say, well, I'm just going to do this, 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 this. Or maybe they'd say, yeah, I need to talk about what's happening to me because I'm scared to death and I can't let my spouse know that I have to put up this brave front for him or her. And I can't let my kids know because they're just saying, come on, Mom, you can do this. And what I feel like is just giving up. And maybe you say, maybe you give an I statement and you walk in and say, as you're sitting there, you say, you know, I just feel so sad for what you're going through. It really hurts me to see all you've had to go through. And the person says, thanks. Because I'm sad too, and they go on. You could get stories, you could get feelings, you could get anger, you could get dreams, you could get a whole lot of things, you may get nothing at all. But by your questions, they know that you're open to feelings. And you're not going to judge where they are with those feelings. But as a person gets closer to dying, sometimes they don't talk in very direct, easy ways. And some of these phenomena kind of throw us. So one of the phenomena that these nurses discovered is that people find themselves, people who are dying, talking to people that we can't see, talking to people who have already died. I didn't bring the book along, but Billy Graham, in his book, Angels, God, Secret Agents, talk about his maternal grandmother who's dying in the book, and I can almost give you the quote verbatim. He says, my maternal grandmother was dying. She was out on a farm. She sat up in bed and almost laughingly said, because she's on her deathbed, I see Jesus, and he has his arms outstretched to me. Mm-hmm. And then she looked away, and the other way she said, and I see Ben, and Ben was her husband that had died previous to her. And then her eyes got really big, and she said, and I see the angels. And she slumped over, absent from the body, but present with the Lord. End of quote. Now, I love that because, you know, any of us would be pleased just to have one of those things, right? Just to see Jesus would be good enough. And here, you know, his maternal grandmother gets to see all three. Now I have to tell you a story about Ruthie, who's one of my patients. Ruthie was a lady in her 80s. I walked into her room on the urology floor. We sat down. She was as pleasant a little lady she could ever find. I was in her room about 45 minutes. We talked. She belonged to the Moline Gospel Temple, and I knew, and she knew what her faith was all about. And she and I were talking. All of a sudden, I was talking to her, we're the only ones in the room, and she looked past me, and she got this great big smile on her face, and her eyes got really big. So I turned around because I thought somebody had walked in who was very important to her. There was nothing there. So we continued in the conversation. She was telling about her life and her children and her church, and all of a sudden she did that again, and that was the other side. And her eyes got really big, and she smiled. So I turned around again. There's nobody there. So somebody said, "Ruthie, what do you keep looking at and smiling at?" And she looked at me kind of incredulously, and she said, "Well, Jesus." And I went, "Really? My heart's going a little faster." And I said, "He's here." And she said, "Yes." And I said, "What's he doing?" And this is a quote. And she said, "He has his arms outstretched to me." And I said, "Ruthie, that must be very comforting to you." She said, "Oh, it is. It was just kind of matter of fact." And I'm getting nervous because this happens two more times in our conversation, and I'm thinking, I wonder what he's thinking. I mean, am I doing this right? I mean, you know, I mean, I was a little nervous. I mean, there's your boss, the ultimate boss, standing behind you, and you're a chaplain. I'm going, oh my God. It was delightful. But I want to tell you that Ruthie was not hallucinating. Ruthie was not on drugs. For 45 minutes, there was not one incoherent sentence in our conversation. Late afternoon, I was going home, and there was this hustling back and forth in Ruthie's room. And I went to the room, and I said to the nurses, "What's going on?" And they said, "Ruthie's, she's not conscious anymore. We're losing some blood pressure. We don't know what's going on." And I said, "I don't know if you're Christians, but this morning Ruthie saw Jesus in a room. And I think you need to call her family," who was two nieces. They called her family. I had to leave. I was the chaplain on call that night, and I got called back an hour and a half later to be told that Ruthie had died. Her nieces came. I told them the story of this morning, of that morning, as tears rolled down their eyes, and they said, "We couldn't get here in time to be with Ruthie when she died, but how wonderful to know that Jesus was there when Ruthie died." Mm-hmm. Wonderful. Love, Ruthie. I'm a person who likes to fix things, so it's been really hard for me to learn how to be a chaplain, because I want to fix things. So the story I'm about to tell you, I wouldn't have been sensible enough to have done. The story is about Emma. Emma is one of the stories in Final Gifts, and she was saying to the hospice nurse, "If only I could relax, if only I could relax." In the beginning of my ministry as a chaplain, I would have said, "Well, can I fix your pillows, or you know, bring you a drink of water, or do you need a pill, or you know, I would mark them." The hospice nurse said, "What would happen if you relaxed?" I never asked that question. But listen to what I would have missed. "Well, that light would get closer, and all those people, I would get to know all those people." The hospice nurse says, "What people?" Emma looks surprised, as if I was asking a ridiculous question. "Well, all these people around my bed," she said, waving to the size of the crowd. The nurse then reassured her. "You will relax, Emma. This is a safe place. You will get to know all these people, and the light will get closer." I'd have missed that. But she knew how to ask the right question. We did have I want to tell you the story about Julie. Julie was a patient I absolutely loved. She was 40 years old, a mom of two young, beautiful children. She had a devoted husband. She had cancer, and she always said to us, "I'm going to come back here when I get done with this cancer, and I'm going to help young moms get through this journey of going through cancer treatment." But Julie didn't get to do that because Julie died at age 40. A couple months after Julie died, Linda came to our oncology unit. And Linda was a really angry woman. She was 39 years old. She had two small boys. She was dying. She knew it, and she was furious. In her anger and alienation, she was pushing everybody away. Spouse, kids, parents, staff, everybody. We had a special room. Not long ago, dying people used to get shoved to the end of a corridor. Not anymore. But we had this wonderful room that had two walls of windows. It was big. It was spacious. You could see the lights of the city at night and the trees during the day. And it wasn't on the path that people walked by, but it was close enough that the nurses could be near there. Late evening, Linda was moved to that room. Several hours later, in the middle of the night, she started screaming at the top of her lungs, "I want to get out of here! I want to get out of here! There's too many dead people in this room!" The nurses ran to her, said, "Linda, what's wrong?" She said, "I'm not staying in this room. There's too many dead people in here. Get me out of here." She did not know. There's no way she could have known that we many times use that room for people because of its beauty and size and location. The nurse said, "No problem, Linda. We will move you back to your room." Her room was right across from the nurse's station. It was small. She could be watched. That morning, they let her sleep, closed her door. Her husband came. He was told, "Linda didn't do well last night." He went in to see her. She smiled at him, and she said, he said, "I hear you had a bad night." She said, "Oh, yes, I was in that other room. I didn't like it. There were too many dead people in there." And she had this great big smile on her face, and she said, "But I'm fine now." She said, "Because Julie came to talk to me." Her husband said, "Honey, who's Julie?" She said, "Well, Julie, you know, Julie." He said, we don't have any relatives named Julie. I don't think we have any friends named Julie. Is it somebody from work? Is it somebody I don't know?" She just looked at me and she said, "It was Julie, and I'm fine. I need to rest now." She turned over. So the husband goes out and goes, "Who was in my wife's room this morning?" The nurse said, "We haven't let anyone in the room." He said, "She hasn't any friends?" "No." "How about a chaplain or a social worker or a lab person?" "No one has been in here. We've made sure of that because she had such a bad night." He recounts the story. The nurses at the station eyes get very big, and they say, "Let's call a chaplain." I sat down with her husband and said, "I can't prove anything to you, but Julie said," and I recounted the story of Julie. And then I Xeroxed the chapter in this book, how people who have died previously come back. And I said, "Julie always said, I'm going to help young moms get through this. Of course, nothing we can prove, but that young woman, Linda, died peacefully a week later. That day, as she woke up later, she called her husband in, she called her children to her, she called her pastor in, she invited her friends in, and she started saying goodbye. The anger was gone, the agitation was gone, the acceptance was there. Mm. I've had several patients that have seen angels, and I'm not going to touch on that. There's a tape in the library that I made several years ago called Angels, an Extension of the Arm of God. And it talks about angels ministry and my view of that as a hospital chaplain. You're welcome to check that out. But many of the times, the children that have experienced angels in our hospital have been children whose parents haven't been emotionally and spiritually and physically able to be there, if you can believe that, while their children are dying and in the process of that. And their stories are recounted in there. But many times it has been children that have seen angels. This place was why I want to explain the title of my talk, Gifts and Blessings Pouring from the Dying. Obviously, you know this now. The dying are getting gifts from us, but they are also giving gifts by the things that they do for those who are sitting around the bedside seeing this. And when you see someone who has seen a loved one, who has seen, for example, Jesus, or who has seen their spouse that died recently, we feel at peace, because we know that life isn't just the here and now. And if my being a chaplain has taught me anything, it has taught me that they're definitely without, I don't have a shadow of a doubt that there is a life after death, because my patients in their dying process have shown me that. Another pattern that we see, another thing I want to say is, I really believe that when people are in this nearing death awareness, their reality expands. And I don't know how to better explain that than that you and I see what you and I see, we're healthy. But as people get closer to death, what they see expands to that spiritual realm that we can't explain, but that they can see. And these, the angels, the people who have died, and I don't have any better term or explanation from that, but that they, what they see is very real. Another parallel or pattern or theme that we see is people who are getting ready to travel or talking about time. Mm-hmm. We had a secretary at our hospital whose father-in-law, he was dying, and he said to his daughter-in-law, I have an appointment at 1:10. And she said, she was dying, and he was home, he was in hospice, and she went back out to tell the rest of the family, you know, dad says he has an appointment at 1:10. Is the hospice person coming? Is the nurse coming? Is the minister coming? Who's coming at 1:10? And they said, you know, he's just on morphine. I mean, you know, nothing's happening at 1:10. He's going to be just, you know, nothing. They don't have any appointments scheduled. At exactly 1:10, that was 3 hours, she is 3 hours previous to this, at exactly 1:10 that afternoon, he died. How can we explain that? Except that in some way, he knew when his time was up. We can't ever discount anything that the dying are trying to tell us. Many times when they get to this point, sometimes they become kind of glassy-eyed, distracted, they seem preoccupied. But if they say something to us, that's when we need to listen. Ellen was a patient that was referred to in Final Gifts. She was dying of cancer. She was a young woman. She was being home, taken care of by her parents. She kept saying three things over and over and over and over again. I want to go home. Where's the map? I'm lost. She was in her house. Her parents were taking care of her. I want to go home. I'm lost. Where's the map? Her parents were frantic trying to figure out, you know, what she was doing and what she was saying about this. Yeah, glad. So the hospice nurse came and said, do you have a summer home? Nope. Well, are you Christians? And they said, yeah. And light bulb went on. Well, of course, we refer to heaven as our other home. And the hospice worker said, let's go back and talk to her, using that as the metaphor. She went in and said, Ellen, you will find the map. We understand what's happening to you. We'll help you find the map. You're not lost. We're going to be here for you. She immediately calmed down. She was understood at that point. Understood. I had a patient once that I had communicated with and talked to. But the daughter was the one that came to me one day, and we were talking about her mother, and she said, "Mom is just fine sometimes, very lucid. And then sometimes she will wake up and she'll say, 'I have to get the dishes done, I have to get the dishes done, I have to get the dishes done.' And I say, 'Mom, you're in a hospital, they do the dishes for you, don't worry. You know, they'll do the dishes, you know, we'll just put them on the tray. She said, I gotta do the dishes. Well, thank goodness I had read this book. And I said to the daughter, "Is your mom the sort of person who, when she leaves the house, has all the dishes done, and the counters are clean, and the paper is folded on the table, and her shoes are in the closet?" She looked at me and she said, "Yes." And I said, "Next time your mom is lucid, say to her, 'Mom, are there any papers at home that you want to take care of? Are there, you know, bills to be paid, or a will, or taxes, or anything like that that you need to be, have to get your affairs in order?'" Okay, I'll give it a try. I came back, it was the weekend, I came back Monday, and she came running down the hall to me. And she said, "I did that." And she said, "We brought all the papers in, Mom had a whole list of things you wanted to do." She has never brought up the dishes again. But if I hadn't read this book, I'd have never known. I just thought, you know, another loony patient on morphine. But we never want to discount that. Along with sometimes people that we can't see, sometimes people see places that we can't see. People will be looking at a white hospital wall in front of them and they'll say, "Oh, it's so beautiful." And you say, "What's so beautiful?" And most of the time they can't tell you what they see. They'll just say, it's beyond words. And you want them to give you more. But most of the time, they can't tell you anymore because they absolutely can't put it into words. But they get a peace and a comfort from what they see, and it brings them that comfort. Bobby was a 32-year-old who was dying of cancer, and the hospice nurse came and said, "What can I do for you?" And he said, "I am scared to death of what's going to happen to me physically." And he said, "So I need to know what's going to happen." And so as a hospice nurse, she went through what she thought was going to happen to him in his final days as his disease progressed. And she explained that to him, and then he went into a coma. And after 3 days of being in a coma, he sat up in bed, he opened his eyes, and he said to his brother and sister who were taking care of him, out of the clear blue sky now after 3 days, "I can see the light down the road, and it's beautiful." And then he died. Now the brother and sister called in, they were Catholic, and they called the priest to the home. And I love what the priest did. They recounted this last remarkable experience. And he said, "What do you think your brother was telling you?" The priest said. And his brother said, "He must have been seeing heaven." And then this is what the priest said. "Our Christian faith is based on the suffering, death, and resurrection of Jesus. You witnessed your brother's suffering and his death, and then he gave you a glimpse of his resurrection." Don't you love it? He gave you a glimpse of his resurrection. Sometimes when people are dying, they need to be given permission. It's okay to go. I have sat at the bedside where that permission was not given. Some one of those family members couldn't let mom or dad or spouse go, so that loved one will hang on and hang on and hang on until either that permission is given, or sometimes until that loved one who is far away gets there. Remember, I was working in an ICU once, and the person was hanging on. You could see the blood pressure was dropping, and I said to them, "Your son is on the way. He's at the airport. Hold on. Just hold on. He's on his way." I said to the rest of the family, "Come in and say goodbye, because you don't have much longer." That son came from the airport. I said to him, "You have a few minutes. Go in and tell your mother," I can't remember his mother's mother, "goodbye, because she has been waiting for you." He walked in. He had about 7 minutes with mom, and she died. They will wait for that person, and they will hold on. Dying people oftentimes know when their death will occur, and they can use that time wisely. I remember I was working with, I thought, just the wife, because whenever I went into this patient's room, he was lying on his bed with his back, on his back with his eyes closed, and I thought that he was in a coma. I would talk to the wife, and one sentence she said is something about, my bed is at the top of the stairs, and he went, our bed. And I just about fell off the chair, because I didn't know he was aware, conscious, or could talk, or was listening. And she laughed and said, oh yes, that's right, our bed. Well, the next day, he kind of rallied and said, tomorrow's my 80th birthday. I always wanted to live to be 80, so I want a party. I want everyone here, I want cake, I want ice cream, I want balloons, and I want to make sure all my family's here. So everybody gathered and they had the party. And after that party, which was a gala affair, he had always wanted to be 80. After that gala affair, he brought his grandchildren forward, and he kissed them, and he told them how much he loved them. And he gave them some little bit of advice. And he did that to his children, and he did that to his spouse. And that late afternoon, he went into a coma, and that next day he died. People can use that time however they want to use it, and they can wait until that event, they want that event to happen. He wanted to be 80. He made sure that he did. Another patient, the muscular dystrophy patient, is referred to in this book, was in his 20s. He had gone to the hospital with pneumonia, and one afternoon, he called up all of his family and his friends, and he told them how much he loved them. Now, he had been in the hospital a lot with pneumonia. They'd kind of in and out, swinging doors sort of thing. But this time, he called everyone in his family at work or left messages on their machines, in their dorm rooms, whatever, he's a college student, and told them how much he loved them and thanked them for all the things that they had done for him in his life as a student, as a son, as a brother. That afternoon, the people who got off work, left their classes, came to visit him as they always did. He was in a coma, and 2 days later, he died. What's significant about that is that, you know, we don't like to think about it, but death is one of the more significant things we do in our lives. I mean, it's our death. And if we can use the time that we have and use it significantly, how more important and touching that particular time can be. So that we can participate in that important event rather than just kind of, it's over. I'll stop for a moment and ask if you have any questions at this point or responses. As again, we'll wait till the stories, till after. Otherwise, I'm going to forge ahead. Okay, I'm forging. Sometimes people need to reconcile. They have to have someone there, or they have to have certain circumstances set up, and a person will prolong their death. I've told you some of those stories, but I have to tell you Debbie's story. Debbie was a 23-year-old patient, and she came to us, and the first time I talked to her, I spent about an hour with her, and Debbie said to me, Jeannie, I want to live long enough so that my 4-year-old will remember me. She was a gutsy lady. She didn't have a spouse, but she had a mom and dad who were very supportive, very loving. She came in and out of the hospital for several years. When she got really sick, I would go home, every Friday I'd kind of go in and not let her know, but in my own mind I was saying goodbye to Debbie because I knew she would be there on Monday. She had gotten so thin and so sick that I knew she couldn't make it through the weekend, so I'd say goodbye and Monday morning I'd get there, Debbie was still there. This went on week after week after week. She got so thin that her eye, you could see back into her eye sockets, and she looked like the pictures of the concentration camp victims in the Holocaust. Well, I was going to Arizona, and I was going to be gone for a week. So I knew that Debbie would be gone when I came back, so I went in and very tearfully said goodbye to Debbie. While I was in Arizona is when I read this book. And when I got back, Debbie was still living. And I met her mother in the hallway, and I said, I can't believe that Debbie is still here. And her mother broke up crying and said, I can't believe either. Why doesn't she just let go? Why doesn't she let go? I can't stand to see her suffering anymore. What is it? And I said, with fear and trembling, maybe there's something that Debbie hasn't done that she needs to do. Maybe there's something holding her back. I said, have you asked her that? And she said, no. And she said, will you? I wasn't planning on practicing out this book quite yet. But I went in there and she said, I can't do it and I can't be there when you do it, but will you ask her? Because I can't stand it. So I went into Debbie's room. Skinny as she was sitting in a chair. And I got down and I said, you know, I said, Debbie, I said, you have put up an amazing fight with this cancer. You have gone years fighting it. You have learned how to say goodbye to your daughter. You have written her letters. You have told her about your faith. You have pictures taken with her that so she'll be able to remember who you are. You've prepared her. You fought a good fight. You've been struggling really a lot now. And it's hard for you, and it's hard for your folks to see you struggling, and I'm paraphrasing what I said. I don't know all what I said. I said, is there something that's holding you back that you have to do yet? And she said something to me, and I couldn't get it. And I prayed, oh God, please let me know what she's saying, because she's giving me the answer she's telling me. So I said, please, Debbie, repeat it. She told me again, and I couldn't get it. I said, Debbie, I'm so sorry. I can't understand what you're saying. Would you write it for me? And she wrote, they're bringing her. By this time, her mother had come back. And I knew they were meaning Letitia, her daughter. And I looked at her mom and I said, you want your parents to bring your daughter here so you can say goodbye? And she nodded. And I said, kind of knowing the situation, I said, your parents haven't brought Letitia. I said, because this is hard for me to say, Debbie, but this illness has not been kind to you. And we haven't, your parents haven't brought Letitia because we thought it might be too upsetting to her. But if you need to see her in order to say, in order to leave, and you need to say goodbye, we'll bring her. And she leaned back in her chair and she mouthed so I could understand it, no, I understand. And she died within 36 hours. But she was waiting for that. And had we not asked the question, it was really hard for me to ask that question, because you don't want to say to somebody, why aren't you dying? I mean, that isn't a cool question to ask someone. But you do want to know what's holding you back that is making this so painful to you. Again, if I hadn't read the book, I wouldn't know. But sometimes people are more upfront and they can tell you what they need much more easily. And so I want to explain a situation that I had, and now we're going to get to stuff that is a little bit easier, because we're working with people that aren't on their deathbed, but are in that process of dying. Well, I guess this lady really is, but at least she can communicate. And people can tell you right up front what they need. Sometimes when I have an experience that's kind of overwhelming for me and powerful for me, I have to go back and I have to write it up. Because I have to, what I call, debrief it. I have to get it out of my system on paper. And if I don't have a person to debrief with, that's best to do that. But then sometimes I also have to write it out. So I'm just going to read to you about an experience I had in the intensive care unit, as it is here. It's someone that really can tell you what they need. The nurse in ICU said, quote, she's only 52 years old. She's dying of heart and lung problems. She's a do not resuscitate and she wants to talk. Her husband and her son are with her. As I entered and introduced myself, she looked up and in between difficult breaths, she said, I can't go on anymore. It's just too hard. You've been through a lot, I said, and I took her hand. Yes, and I'm too tired to fight anymore. Remember, she's only 52 years old. Her husband and son nodded to me, affirming her long, hard struggle. They talked about her illness and its history, which she couldn't do because she didn't have enough energy to do that. I just want to die, she said. Judy, we will do everything we can to make this easy for you, I said. And then I said, what do you need to do to die peacefully? She thought only for a moment and then she said, I need to talk to my four children and my father. I nodded to her husband. Can you arrange that? He nodded yes, but we still need to ask more questions. And what do you need from them? And this answer is absolutely remarkable to me, and it says to me, she'd been thinking about this. I need them to give me their blessing, that it's okay with them, and that they'll let me go. She knew that if somebody didn't let her go, that she couldn't, that she'd have to hang on. I looked at both her husband and her eldest son, and then they nodded, but with tears in their eyes. Judy, your husband will arrange for your family to come. She seemed to relax a bit, but was still tense. I knew that such and such a Methodist church was listed as their church. Is there a pastor you would like to see from your church? I said. We don't know him very well. He's new. We went on to discuss how it would be helpful to have him called at this time since he would be doing her funeral service. But she was still tense and she was still gripping my hand. Are you afraid, Judy, of what lies ahead? I said to her. She nodded and she grabbed my other hand. Would you like me to share with you what may happen to you as you approach your transition from this world to the next? She nodded. I then shared with her the physical slowdown of her body, how the nurses and doctors would do everything they could to keep her comfortable, and finally how her spirit would live from her body. I asked her who had died previous to her that would be there to greet her. She smiled, and she named her mother and a son. I asked her if I could pray a prayer for a peaceful transition, and we made a circle with her husband and her son, and I prayed, incorporating all of this. She then laid her head back in the pillow and sighed. She seemed relaxed for the first time. I'm tired now, she said, and she closed her eyes. I turned to her husband and said, may I suggest that we ask for a private room up on the floors so that you and your whole family can have as much privacy and room as you need. You need to know, if you have a family member in a hospital, that if this situation arises and this person has chosen to die and you don't need or want all of that machinery and that noise and that technology, that you have a right as a family member and as a person who is sick to ask to be moved to another room. I went out, I worked with the hospital and we got them moved. I am told that Judy died peacefully 1.5 days later in a private room surrounded by her family. Sometimes people are much more upfront on exactly what they need. Sometimes people need reconciliation with God. They need a priest to come and they can tell you that. They need absolution. They need the sacrament. They need a prayer. They need to talk with somebody about what went on in Vietnam X number of years ago, or about the abortion they never had told anybody about, etc., etc. Some need to heal relationships with family members or friends. Some need to express gratitude. Some need to get an apology from someone or give an apology. The hardest stories, I think, are from the AIDS patients. Bill was a 27-year-old AIDS patient. Mom said, I'm bringing Bill home to die. Dad said, if you do, I'm leaving and I'm walking out. She brought him home. Dad left. He hung on and he hung on and he hung on. The priest came every other day to minister to him. He didn't die and he didn't die. Finally, the sensitive priest said, do you need to see your dad before you can die peacefully? At this point, he couldn't talk, but nodded yes. So the priest went and said, can you please come home? Bill needs to talk to you. Dad said no. He hung on for 2 more weeks and finally died. The tragedy of that story was not the death. The tragedy, of course, was the estrangement, the unconditional love that could not be given. Sometimes we can step back even farther as caregivers and loved ones. Everybody who's dying, I believe this as an absolute, needs to know that their life was important and significant and that what they did in their life counted for something. And we can do that in a variety of ways. One of the ways we can do that is to say who they're or who we are. We had a befriender. Befrienders are our lay people that are trained to do what we as chaplains do, and I love this person. She had been assigned a person who was dying. Every day she went to her home his home, and she said, tell me about your early life. And she wrote it down. She went home and put it on the computer. The next day she goes, they tell me about your life as. And she went through his whole life. At the end of X number of weeks, she came and presented to him his life story and copies to all his family members. The smile on that man's face, here's my life. Here's who I am, here's what I did, here's the stories and the traditions that will go on and be handed on to my family members. Beautiful. Paul and I have a friend who is dying in Oregon. And the last 3 days of his life, his children came home. And for 3 solid days, they looked at picture albums, which I think is one of the neatest things a person could do. And I suggest this to families as a chaplain. And they sat down and looked at Mel's picture albums from when he was a baby and he told stories, through his times when he got married, and then he and his wife told stories to their children and to each other. And then when the children were born, went through his whole entire life laughing and crying together for 3 days. And if that wasn't the three most important days, especially of the three that were left of their life, I mean, they were the absolute most important days. And what a tribute to who I am and what I have done to share those stories. Many times I suggest to my patients, especially cancer and AIDS patients, where you've got time, is to write letters. Now, some patients won't do this because they have to admit that maybe then they're dying. But I say, okay, so it's a long way away. But you know that spouse who loved that letter, those children? And I have to tell you a story that I have a lot of trouble telling, and I don't know how many times I've told it, but I still have trouble with it. A best friend of mine's sister was dying at 32 of cancer, and she had 3 small children. And she said to her husband one day, go to Toys R Us and pick out 3 dolls or stuffed animals that represent the personalities of our 3 kids. And her kids, as I said, were grade school age kids. She said, do it carefully. He did, and came back with these 3 dolls or stuffed animals. And she said, bring me paper and envelopes. That night, she took each of these animal stuffed dogs, whatever it was, held on to it, and wrote a letter to each of her kids, telling them what she hoped for them, her dreams, her stories, her aspirations, what she hoped they would become. I wrote a letter to each kid, put it in an envelope, and the next day gave it to her husband and said, put it in the top shelf. And after my funeral, when everyone has gone, give these to the children so that when they are lonely, they can hug these animals and know that I have spent a night hugging and holding onto these animals and dolls, and that they will have to be the things that hug them for me, and then give them these letters. Death is an awful thing for little kids and spouses to have to endure. But I can imagine the healing and the connections that took place because of those animals and those letters. Yes, children and spouses feel abandoned when mom or dad dies, but that abandonment and that healing already begins to take place when there's something to hold and something to read. Sometimes people need somebody there. But how often I have discovered people will die when there's no one there. And amazingly enough, it's children. Children have said to me, my mom and dad can't handle this, you know. So mom or dad will step out to get a cup of coffee, to take a shower, to go downstairs and get a crust of bread, and they'll come back and the child has died. And I'm going to tell you this story, and I hope you never forget it, so that you can pass this on to somebody who's kicking themselves because they left and this loved one died. And that's this, is that many times the dying person will say, by their act of dying alone, that is my final gift to you. I say to someone, and they're beating themselves up, why did I go do that, that, that? And I say, the person loved you so much that they didn't want you there when they died. because they didn't know if it would be easy or difficult in that moment of transition, and they wanted to spare you from it. And so they wanted you to come back and just see them lying there peacefully. That was their final gift to you. Accept it as that. That can sometimes be also the beginning of healing and not beating themselves up, because we always say, if only I had, and that's the first thing we say when someone dies. Sometimes people wait until a particular date, as I told you about, that there was one little, I had to tell you the story of a little gal who didn't die because she was a high school kid and her graduation and homecoming, graduation and prom were that weekend. So she said, I can't die, Mom, because it will spoil my friend's weekend. She died the Monday after that graduation weekend. Sometimes people need to wait till that prodigal son or daughter has come. A quick story, somebody was holding on. I said to the spouse, is there some reason Betty is not dying? He said, well, yeah, she hasn't seen her son for 7 years. And I said, where does that son live? Thinking Alaska. Oh, over here 20 miles in Sherrard. And I said, do you think she could be waiting? Could be. I said, do I have your permission to call them? Sure, go ahead. I called, and he said, well, he doesn't have a phone. And he said, but he's been in trouble with the law. I called the police at that little bitty town of 200 and said, do you know so-and-so? Yeah, we know him. I said, go over and tell him that if he wants to see his mother alive, he needs to get to Genesis Medical Center. Within 2 hours, that young man was there sitting at his mother's bedside. She then rallied for 3 more days, found the extra strength then to catch up on all the time they had missed. The last thing I'm going to do is to talk about how to talk someone through their transition from this world to the next. I don't know how to do that except to also give you this example of a time that I had the privilege of doing this. I believe as a chaplain, I have one of the neatest jobs in the whole world, because I believe that so often I'm on sacred ground. And this had to have been one of the most sacred grounds I was on. And it also is one of the reasons that I put this together. I was called into a room. Obviously, I've never even rewritten this one. It's such a mess that I had trouble even reading my own writing. I was called into a room of a woman who was 47 years old. She was dying of cancer. Her mother was in there. Her husband went in and out of the room because he couldn't handle it. Father came in. I was told to go in, that she was 47, advanced cancer, a do not resuscitate. She might have had a stroke. She was in a semi-comatose state. I went in and started talking to the mother, and I said, tell me stories about Carol. Tell me about who she was. So the mother started to recount stories to me, but all of a sudden, Carol became extremely agitated. She was thrashing in her bed. Her head was back. Her eyes were closed. Her arms were going. She was getting extremely agitated, and all of this was escalating. So we called for the nurse to come in. The nurse came in. They were trying to give her some stuff in her IVs. That wasn't helping. Her mother was then getting agitated because she couldn't calm her down, and so everything was escalating with Mom. I said, and I looked at the nurse, and she was trying to give her something. I said to the mother, would you like me to talk to Carol? She said, yes, please do, and we'll go on from there. Carol was extremely agitated. I took her hand and asked permission from her mother to talk with her. I said, Carol, I know it isn't easy for you. In fact, it's very hard. I moved closer to her. You're having trouble breathing and you're feeling scared. But Mary Lou, your nurse, is here, and she's going to give you a shot that will make you feel less stressful. In fact, you may feel very sleepy. We're here and we're going to take care of you. But it wasn't working. And the look on the nurse's face as the nurse and I are communicating with our eyes was that things were getting progressively worse, not better, and that this was when Carol was dying. And I looked at the nurse and she said this, and I said to her mother, I think this might be Carol's time. Do you want to talk with her? Do you want me to help her? And she said, no, just do something. She said, do something. So I again went on to talking to Carol. I said, Carol, we're here. Your mother is here. Your husband is here because he had come in. Your father is here, and we're going to help you through this. Carol, I think this is your time, and we're going to be here to make it easy as possible. But it's still, she's flailing back and forth. I said, Carol, you're going to relax. At some point in time, you're going to take a breath in this world, and you're going to take a breath in the next. And then you'll have made the transition from this world. All of a sudden, she stopped fighting, and she was laying perfectly still, but with her head back. You'll be leaving this earthly body. You'll be leaving pain behind. You'll be leaving this labored breathing. You'll be able to move with freedom. And her mother had told me that she was a Catholic. I know that you're a Catholic, and you have probably a better understanding of angels than we Protestants do. And I said, so you probably know that you've had a guardian angel that has watched over you your entire life. And that guardian angel has been watching you then, and is watching over you now. And perhaps will be here as an escort angel to lead you to your new home. Now, her head had been up like this, and she had stopped struggling, but as I was talking to her, she was moving her head down, and her arms became very quiet by her side. And I was holding her hand. You'll be seeing a bright light, and you'll be drawn to it because you're being drawn to the love of God. Now, as I'm saying this, her head is now moving, and I'm standing outside her bed, and her head is moving toward me, and is now looking directly, her head is directly at me, and she opens her eyes. I know you don't want to leave this family behind, but your new family, those who have died before you in Christ, will be there to welcome you, and you'll be home. Her eyes are now wide open, and they are locked totally into mine. So, Carol, I'm going to touch your forehead, and I'm going to remind you of your baptism. You were signed and sealed with the cross of Christ at your baptism. You were declared His with this sign. I made the sign of the cross on her forehead. You can rest in that peace as God's child. You don't need to be afraid. It will be easier than you think. I hesitate to call it death, Carol, as I'm now stroking her face. Because we really don't end. We simply move from this world to a better one. I look at Mary Lou now, who's taking her blood pressure and is giving me a look that we're going to lose her soon. So I'm now stroking her face, and I keep talking to her, reassuring her, telling about God's love and the ease of which she is going to move from this world to the next. Her eyes then glass over, and her head falls to the side. I turned around, and her mother was turning right next to me, and tears were streaming down both of our eyes. I hugged her mother, did the appropriate things that I needed to do in that room, and walked out to the nurse's station. And the department head looked at me, and this isn't a woman of faith. In fact, she's a lapsed Catholic who is not practicing her faith at all, and said to me, I hear you're a midwife. And I looked at her, and it just went right over my head, and you know, she could tell that I didn't get it, and she said, I hear you midwifed someone into the next world. And I kind of smiled and said, yeah, I guess so. Later, realizing that was one of the highest compliments I think I had ever been given. But as I walked dazed to my office and walked toward my boss, spiritual mentor, and best friend's office where I needed to debrief this, the angrier I got with myself. And as I sat down in his office and slammed the door, I recounted this incident and I said to him, it shouldn't have been me. Her mother was there who gave her birth. Her husband was there who chose to marry her. Her father was there, and she was looking at me when she was dying. I talked to her. And he, in his wisdom, said to me, in that story, I heard you ask permission from her mother. And I said, yes, I did. And I heard you say the husband couldn't even stand to be in the room because he was walking back in and out of it and wasn't even there when she died. Could anyone else in that room have done that? And I said, I don't think so. And he said, then you had to do it. And that's when I recounted the last paragraph in this book. Most important, don't give in to the understandable temptation to be in the middle of this exciting communication. It's neither your right, Jeannie Olson, nor your honor. It is your role to teach friends and family members and Holden guests how to listen, understand, and respond appropriately to a dying person's message. It's your right, and it's your privilege, and that is sacred ground for you. And I just hope for you that what you have taken away from this class, which I hope is practical, and what you would pick up in this book, which I highly recommend, and that if you send this book to someone else, that you can glean and be there for someone else and be there for that loved one so a chaplain doesn't have to have that privileged state. I know I have run over. I would now open it up for questions for those of you who need to leave and for any shared experiences, and if anybody needs any Kleenexes, certainly. Questions, responses, and anyone needs to go, please feel.
What's the name of that book? I hated that. Is that
Final Gifts? Final Gifts is in the bookstore. The other one is not, but I only purchased it once.
I think ask a question in the morning. That's what I'm feeling. I feel now feeling kind of overwhelmed. Like, let me step away. Ask me what I thought about it in the morning.
Okay. And that. Thank you for saying that. If any of you want to ask a question later, want to respond later, said I couldn't do it, like Julie's saying, I couldn't do it now, but I'd like to talk to you personally. That's what I'm here for. And I only have one other session, so. And that's tomorrow, so I am free to be able to do that with anybody. Or if you want to read the book and discuss any bit of it too. Thank you.
Yeah,
thank
you. Amen.
That's
great.
Amen. I took a parishioner, I'm a nurse, and I took there's parish nurses now.
Mm-hmm. They're wonderful. I can say your question loud and clear.
Well, I took the parish nurse program, and this is what I learned. I mean, they talk a lot about. There's a nurse theorist named Parse, and her idea is that everyone, because nurses are controlling and they want to fix their all that stuff, and the theorist talked about that everyone's health is their own idea of what health is, and I can tell somebody to take their blood pressure medicine or go to the doctor or whatever, but really people want to decide that themselves, and they will decide that themselves. Yeah. Now, we talked a lot about the dying and what to do, and this woman named Parse talked about having presence with people.
Oh, wonderful word. Wonderful.
Right. And I have not done the parish nursing program, done the parish nursing in my church for very long, but one of the stories I have to tell, and it has to do with presence, is the woman that came into the church, I could take her blood pressure. She didn't need to have her blood pressure taken, but she would come in. The church secretary warned me about it. He said, don't take anything that Eleanor says personally, don't worry about her, she's just like that. Well, the first time I took Eleanor's blood pressure, she barely sat down on the chair. She sat down on the chair, she didn't have blood pressure taken anymore. And then as soon as I took it, she got up and went, wow, I can't get her on the market. And she had a high effect, just listening to her. She said,
Truly a gift. And that leads into my session tomorrow, which is being comfortable with the uncomfortable, how to get the stories out of those people who are visiting in the nursing homes and come to us as parish nurses, and that shutting down the streets, and those people that it isn't always comfortable to do that, but you get wonderful stories. And that's really all they need, is our presence and our listening and our affirmation. And what a gift we give them just by listening. Yeah. But it's wonderful. I'm glad there's a collective out there doing that. It's healing. Stories and storytelling is healing. They're life-changing. Like in Dan's talk this morning, when he talked about going down into the kiva, the stories and how important they are to know who we are, getting those stories.
My only experience with that so far has been with people dying in accidents or suicide. And hearing what you had to say, it just makes that all the more tragic for the people involved and the people remaining on this earth, because you don't have the ability to go through this.
No, it's process. Just they're gone.
Yeah, just
they're
an observation. Because you always think, well, dying a long, slow death, what an awful thing. But
well, it's the last thing you said to them, and you know, if only I had, and much
sure. Have you had any experience where they actually kind of like, where people, they talk about their previous experiences? I mean, my grandfather, when he was dying, was talking about his wife and things that they had done many, many years before, and she'd actually died before him. Is that common? Or is
talking about life review, as if the person there just talking about their life when?
Both.
I think that life review, when people, I'm going to talk about this tomorrow, but when people talk about my life when, you know, back when, they're doing that life review to get a perspective on, was my life good? You know, it's really important to be able to listen to those stories and have them tell those stories. Because sometimes people say, I didn't have much of a life. I say, well, tell me about your kids, tell me about your work, and all of a sudden they sit a little straighter, and they tell about all the things their kids are doing, and I say, you're really proud of your kids, aren't you? You know, your kids are doing some neat things. Sounds like you are really a good dad. Oh, yeah. And all of a sudden their life did have meaning, and what they did in life. Because if the person is older, you know, it's kind of like, those were my glory days when I did, you know. So talking about that's so wonderfully important. Yeah. I don't know if I answered that. What was the other part? Or talking
part about? to his wife.
Who's already died. Yeah. I mean, that's
like
the part.
Like many years before.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And it may be that hours, days, or even weeks before, people may talk to people that they see. Like Ruthie saw, you know, Jesus and Billy Graham's maternal grandmother saw Ben. Ben was her husband that had died previous to her. And he was there. And I do believe people can come back and help in that transition, saying, come on, it's okay. Yeah. People who had near-death experiences, you know, how many of them see people who've died before and say, yeah, come on, or it's not your time yet, you know, go back. Or I believe in those.
Or is it sometimes, I don't know this, I'm asking, less remarkable in the sense that they really are delusional and think they are harvesting in 30 years ago. And they think that, you know, that is their spouse bringing lunch out. And they really, so it's
sometimes
not,
it is.
Not
and sometimes
that
it
kind
is
of
more than it is.
But it's more of a remembrance type thing.
Yeah. For sure. Or some of that.
We are angered about the family not being able to be the ones to do it. I guess in my very, very limited experience, and even in the death of my own father, I guess there's a part of me, and my gut says, family members cannot be the primary caregivers in a lot of situations, and that's why it's so important to have other people around.
The primary caregivers for physical care, spiritual care, emotional care, what kind of care?
Definitely physical, I think. Definitely physical. Maybe, I don't know, I guess maybe this is something that I'm still working through. Because I missed a lot of the signs in that book. I read the book after my father died. I wish I would have read it before. But I still wonder, and I kicked myself, which I, you know. But there's still a part of me that says that there are. It's okay to have other people around.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, there is no way that my mother should have been there alone when Dad died. And Dad died by himself, the way he would have wanted to. And Mother is at peace and sees that was Dad's gift to her. But there's just a part of you, and I guess it's hard. And I don't know if families can really be the ones to do it.
But
they should be involved.
Yeah.
Yes, but it's just,
but don't you think everybody's different? I mean, every story and every individual are all unique.
Yeah.
So some people want the whole family right there. Some people want to die alone. Some people want at physical care not to come from family members. I want this professional to bathe me and to, you know, carry out my throw up. And then there are some people who, you know, no, I want, you know, my mother there. I want my...
It can't be such a strong, definite maybe, and not going
to come on. The beauty of it is we need to ask that person, who do you want to take care of you? Again, the dying person or the person who's sick calls the shot.
Yeah.
Who do you want to be your spiritual person? Some people will say, yeah, and unfortunately, there are an awful lot of ministers who are not comfortable in hospitals, who are not comfortable with dying, who are not comfortable with sick people. You know, and they'll come in and, you know, they'll read their prayer, or they'll say their prayer, and they'll get out of there because they're not comfortable with that. And we can't assume that everybody who is ordained is comfortable with dying, with the sick, with whatever. So people, some people say, don't call my minister. He's just too uncomfortable. He's just too uncomfortable here. You know, sit by my bed, tell me, you know. Or some people say, that's just the person I need. You know, because I can talk to him or her, but I can't talk to my spouse because I'm protecting them. I can't talk to my children because I'm protecting them.
Yeah. That gets to something that I'm still working on, the fact that it's just, you know. And I guess maybe that's where it's giving families permission that they really do need to step away.
That's why we ask the person, yeah. You need,
That's a good way to put it. Ask.
How simple. They'll tell you.
We make it
how simple. Yeah.
Put it in. Who would you like to be here?
I want to keep you as Christian.
Do you have any special sessions for children? So often we have discussions with adults, and we had
panels. I'm doing one Friday. Over at Narnia.
Kids grieve, but they've never been allowed to discuss this.
We protect our children,
adults.
And we probably, in this day and age, protect them too much. Years ago, when mom died, mom and dad and grandma died on the farm, right. We all stood around the bed, and, you know. Grandma died, and you know we bathed her, and we you know laid her out in the parlor, and we prayed and we cried, and we protect kids now in a way that is probably not very healthy. Yeah, so I'm doing a session with Darnie on Friday.
I love the session. I love the story. I'm reacting to a lot of different things that are going on, but one of the things I really liked that you said to me was the. Where you add that simple piece of asking them what they want, what they need. Because if you don't do that, I think you don't allow them to have their death. I think sometimes we tend to want the person that we're with, if we don't watch it, we want them to die our death. And I think it's very important that they die their death. And so I think that's the way you could add is by asking them, what do you need?
Sometimes that's the last thing we do, too.
Is it hard for family members to be the caregivers? I had a niece that died like 2-3 years ago, and her sister took care of her. And I think her sister withheld pain medication and everything from her, thinking that it would keep her there longer or something. I don't understand it. It's really hard to understand.
Again, I think you have to ask the patient, you know, what do you want? And I think sometimes it's best that they have a variety, that they have hospice coming in, that they, you know, have family members and sometimes best friends, and that the person, you know, that most important is that you communicate. You know, ask, what do you need, what do you want, what's best? And try and meet that person's needs. I mean, sometimes it is best, sometimes it isn't. I mean, I don't have any formula for that, and that's why what we say is ask the question.
Ask and listen.
Yeah.
What about dementia, Alzheimer's?
Dementia and Alzheimer's?
I mean, in relation to asking people when the
communication is
broken down.
That's hard. You know, I mean, if they have Alzheimer's or dementia, you know. The beauty of what was said in Dan's session this morning is even in dementia and Alzheimer's, you start saying the Lord's Prayer to somebody. And they can chime in because it's part of their very fabric of who they are. And, you know, there can be that connection. But as far as helping them through the process of dying, you can ask and see what happens. You know, sometimes they have that window where they can communicate. I haven't worked with that many Alzheimer's and dementia patients.
But I do think with Alzheimer's and dementia, the last thing that usually goes is their long-term. So maybe there's some comfort in going long-term.
If you say to somebody, you know, tell me about your childhood, or tell me about Uncle, you know, so-and-so, they can probably tell you that, but they couldn't tell you what they had for lunch.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's a good point. And they love telling stories about the past. You've all sat here a long time.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.